tsunami's back, bitches.
Took you long enough.
This has been an experience we will never forget.
This ain't no time to go all mushy.
Don't lecture me. I've waited long enough.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 471 of the Toonami Escape Podcast. I'm C. Kohler, and with me tonight is Seda.
Hello.
Crocodile can't make it this evening. He did say he might show up. I guess it's still possible he might show up, but I don't think so. He said he wasn't really certain it would happen. But we'll go ahead and do an episode without him. And let's begin by talking about the one news item I had, which was they did premiere a new Criminal Threats promo this week, one of those Building a Better Cartoon Show type promos. And I don't know, I know you didn't see this, Seda, but I did see it. I don't remember a whole lot about it, but it's a general thing where they show clips from current airing shows. Although I think I was looking at the thread, and I think Crocodile pointed out that they showed a couple of shows in there that they're not currently airing, which was strange.
Sometimes, like you said, I did not watch the specific promo, but sometimes it feels like it. They get scenes from shows from like maybe a month or two back. It's like, oh, yeah. It's the last few episodes of, I don't know, Mashal or something like that hasn't been on in the block for a bit, but they must still have like the tapes and they clipped it in.
Yeah, he specifically mentioned Lazarus and Blue Exorcist were being shown.
Oh, yeah. I'm guessing why that happens is, you know, they have these tapes that they have, you know, the rights to or whatever to do these sorts of things. And these promos probably come together over the course of maybe a few weeks and, may not line up perfectly with what is airing precisely at the time that the promo airs. So.
That's probably it. Along the same lines, I did notice something else this week, and I'm going to have to keep my eye on this, but the bumps were like super up to date, particularly the One Piece bumps, which were showing like scenes from the episode that was airing. Huh. And I think maybe another show also had like scenes from the episode that was currently airing. And I don't know if they're doing that all the time or not. Here's Crocodile. He just showed up.
We've already started recording, but we are now allowing you in.
We barely started.
Yeah. We haven't actually gotten to the Rooster Fighter yet.
You can hear us, right?
Yes. Sorry. Yes.
So we were just talking about the Criminal Threats promo, and I was mentioning how they were showing a couple. You had mentioned that there were a couple of shows that they were showing in the promo that actually aren't on the block currently.
Yeah, that's very weird because they do these new promos, it's always shows that are on the block, and I could be misremembering what's at the end of the block, but I don't think Lazarus is airing right now, for example, and I think there was another show in there too that wasn't currently, oh, Blue Exorcist is not airing right now, and there was a few clips of that in there too.
Yeah, and then the other thing I was talking about too is that, I don't know if you'd noticed this, Crocodile, but like, the bumps are like super up to date, like the One Piece bumps are the current, they were clips from the current episode, and same from like another show on the block.
I've been noticing they've been kind of more up to date, but I haven't been necessarily noticing if they've been constantly changing or whatnot. Because I remember that was a point of discussion a couple weeks back, or maybe a couple months back. So, but if they're even more up to date too,
I'm gonna pay special attention this weekend to see if they change them again, or if I just happened to catch it during a week when they were changing. But if they change again this week, I'll be like really surprised. I'm like, wow, they're really going all out if that's the case.
Yeah, it's kind of funny. Like bumps themselves, like, do they matter? Like inherently, maybe not. But the fact that they're like giving them effort to, you know, cut clips and, you know, get them in the rotation and update them and whatnot, that it may be like, it may be a symptom that, symptom's not the right word, but that they're actually like giving Toonami some attention and care that they even bother to like change the bumps, because they could easily be like, yeah, just let it be, it's fine, but they don't. They've been updating those. So
I mean, I would say bumps in general are important to Toonami's branding, because like it's not just a random collection of anime or action cartoons. Like as a brand, I think the bumps are important to that, but they don't necessarily have to update them super frequently. It could be once every couple of weeks or months or whatever, and that would probably be enough. So you're right, they're definitely, if they're doing it, keeping them up to date this frequently, that's indicative of maybe something. I guess the pessimistic view could be like, oh, they don't necessarily have the money to get new shows or do other things, so they might as well put effort into the bumps or something. That would be the cynical way to view it. But I think you'd also view the optimistic way in which you're describing, which they just have the tension or the time, whatever, to just quote-unquote splurge on everything. But
yeah, we've seen in the past, or hypothetically even, where it's like if they don't even touch the bumps for like almost a year, it's just like, man, they're just letting Toonami just linger here. They're not even changing the bumps or whatever. But that's not the case. So
yeah, I'd like to point out when they do that, because I feel like, we appreciate, as people who watch, we appreciate the effort that's going into it. And I definitely noticed. So, but like I said, I'm going to pay more attention this weekend and see how much they change on a regular basis. But thank you for doing that. Okay, that's all I had for news. So let's go ahead and get into the rundown. And of course, we will begin with Rooster Fighter. Something's broken. Rooster Fighter Episode 6, Built Like a Brick Coop. Haha, get it. I guess this is Keiji. He's built that way. He's built different. He's built more different than I thought he was, judging by this episode. He's turns out to be straight up Superman,
he's more
practically.
Sleeve than we thought he did.
Yeah. So episode starts out, and again, this is the end of the two-parter that we started with last week. The YouTuber guy that's been stalking them. He's at the dam. He's near the dam. And we kind of see a little bit of his backstory, and that apparently he was like a salary man who was, you know, really negligent at his job and got a lot of criticism from his coworkers. But he didn't do the righteous thing at the time. He was very, very much like selfish and conceited and thought he was great. And he was just lying to himself.
It's a little unusual because these sorts of flashbacks usually, like the woe is me, here's my sad backstory that's going to explain why I'm about to become a demon or whatever. Usually there's like something to sympathize with them, like the Pops character from before. He was abandoned as a child, which means he has trauma for like abandonment issues, basically. And then you kind of saw how that parlayed into the present with what happened to him with his Yakuza quote-unquote friend and whatnot. So there's like a connection there. This flashback, the YouTuber was just like, wow, this guy is an asshole and everyone around him is like objectively correct to be upset with him. Like, this flashback makes him look like a dick. That's usually your own flashbacks make you look good or at least sympathetic.
Well, I think that's the point here, is because he is at this point in the episode still a bad guy.
Correct. But it was just, I kind of didn't expect that necessarily, because like we obviously all thought he was going to become a demon. And so I was like, oh, here's a sob story. But it was not a sob story, which I guess maybe preluded that there was going to be a bit of subversion later. But like, I was just going to say I didn't expect that.
Oh, okay. Fair enough.
I do think, wasn't my recollection that he was lost in the rain and then he followed Elizabeth and Piyoko when they were running to the dam? And then that's how he found his way to the dam, because he was following them?
Yeah, yeah, so something like that. It's like torrential rain right now, and everyone else is like going to the shelter, but he doesn't care about finding shelter. He's literally on his bike in the rain, like, gotta find those chickens. Where are they? And then he eventually sees, I think, Elizabeth running to the dam. But yeah, the only reason why he's out and about is he's looking for chickens.
Yeah, speaking of the shelter, we do get a scene back there. We see all of the townsfolk huddled there, including the little girl and her grandpa and everybody. The YouTuber starts live streaming, and they're watching that on like a television, and he's live streaming what's going on the dam. And some of the people in the town are saying that the dam was poorly built, that it was like, you know, there's rumors that it was not up to code or whatever.
Because I think someone came to the shelter to tell them the dam was about to break, or they feared it was about to break, which I think was a context in which they're watching the actual YouTube stream. So, but.
Yeah, the YouTuber here is actually like providing a pretty, like, you can maybe argue if they need to just watch the dam in live stream or in live action or whatnot, but he's actually providing like a service here to everyone in the shelter. Like, he's the one recording this for them, not a news station, this guy.
Maybe I'm a little old-fashioned, maybe I'm showing my age here, but I was surprised they were watching that on a television. because it's YouTube.
And now their phones, yeah.
I assume someone hooked it up to the TV for the big screen, is my assumption.
Yeah, I mean, they probably have like a smart TV or something, yeah, I guess. Okay, and then he's out there, so he's out there videoing. They did say his name. I don't know if they said his name or it was in the captions, but his name is Ibokura, is this YouTuber guy. And he sees Morio, the demon, is helping try to stop the dam, and he's like shocked by this. And so is Elizabeth and Piyoko, and they're like, aren't you a demon? And he's, you know, we get the scene that was in the promo where he's just like, yeah, but I'm trying to do what's right, you know, that kind of thing.
Trying to find his purpose in life, basically.
Yeah.
I will make one comment that I appreciated. I think both the townsfolk and Ibokura, that's like, everyone thought, when they first saw him, they thought the demon was trying to destroy the dam. So everyone's like, oh, fuck, a demon's here. We're all super fucked. I appreciate that the show didn't linger on that, and everyone was smart enough to realize, like, wait, oh, no, he's helping us. And then they all had a quick change of heart. So, like, I think a lot of shows have lingered on that, like, oh, no, is a demon helping or is he not? Ah, I'm so angry, and such miscommunication, misunderstandings and whatnot. But the show just gets to the point, no, no, the demon's trying to help. Everyone gets that, and everyone tries to cheer him on.
I agree. I think the people in this show in general are very quick to have their opinions changed to a certain degree, but yeah,
they're not one piece NPCs.
No, they're the worst. And this is the moment where Ibokura sort of realizes his failings. He's like thinking back to himself, and now he gets the actual sad. Oh, it's not really sad backstory, but his like realization that he was the cause of all his own problems, that he needs to be a better man, basically.
Yeah, it shows him basically saying, like, he had aspirations to be a lawyer. He failed. He at the time blamed his mom, even though that made no sense. But he kind of realizes, you know, and at this moment, I've always been blaming others and not, like, you know, looking inwards. And he kind of realizes that, like, something needs to change.
But he ends up falling, and he starts falling, and he's gonna, you know, die here. Morio is too busy holding the dam back. He can't help. But then suddenly in comes Keiji and out of nowhere, and Keiji is there and he saves the YouTuber. Then this is a commercial. And when we come back, Keiji and Morio kind of have a conversation, but ultimately Morio can't hold the water back. He's trying as hard as he can, but he can't hold it back. And he kind of gets washed away, and Keiji has like a little moment here where he was like, you're a hero. That's who you are. You're trying to know who you were, but who you are is a hero.
Keiji made sure to tell that to Morio before, like, they had that chat, and like Keiji told that to Morio before the dam broke and washed away, which I think was important for Morio to have that realization, kind of like that appreciation, just someone telling him that he was doing a good job. So I think obviously Morio was kind of like really happy. Like, obviously he wanted to help people, but like the recognition that he was actually helping was just, I think, very uplifting to his spirits. But of course, spirits can't contain raging waters, I guess.
Yeah. And at this point in the episode, which, you know, ends up being subverted at the end, but at this point you're kind of getting this impression, okay, he sacrificed himself. He tried his best, but he's going to die. But of course he doesn't. But we think that at this point. I actually thought
he eventually dies.
That's true. Yeah. But I mean, yes, that's true. Okay, I kind of forgot about that. We'll talk about that.
There was a moment that he was drowning. It looked like he was drowning, and he was like talking to himself, like, I found my purpose. I tried my best. I lived my life, and I'm happy with what I was able to do. So he was like looking like he was drowning, kind of washing away underwater. So like, if that just ended there, that could have been okay. That's end of Morio, and he did sacrifice himself. But obviously, we know more. But yeah, he did have that moment where it did look like he actually did die, and he was having his like final words or final contemplations.
And Keiji, you know, I've got to stop this water. He doesn't know what to do. So this is when Keiji kind of goes to levels I didn't expect. He suddenly can just run at he literally becomes like the Flash. Like, he can move at like lightning speed. And it's not just like he's moving fast. It's like there's an effect. Like, he's literally like a superhero here.
It looks a little bit like he went Super Saiyan 2. You know how Super Saiyan 2 has like the lightning around the body and whatnot? Looks a little bit like he did that. He didn't turn golden, but he did have the electric effect around his body.
And a lot of the art in this part of the episode had like the more like, how do you put it? Like the more like drawn thick black lines mm-hmm. around the characters to like emphasize, you know, their shape and what or whatnot to give them to make them a more like heroic look. Yeah, like right. So and that's and yeah, and as he's moving fast and all that too. So it was definitely like this, like he kind of like reached another level.
It also kind of reminds me of like the Demon Slayers, like when they do like special breathing. I think what's mm-hmm. the annoying dipshit guy who's like only taller when he's asleep, like Kenichi or something? What's his name?
Zengetsu.
Zengetsu in Bleach. It's Zenitsu. There we go.
Zenitsu. I'm like, okay.
And he does like thunder breathing to go like super fast. Like this had a similar effect.
Yeah. Yeah. It's definitely, it's like when they change the art style up slightly and make it look more like sketchy, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. It looked really cool. Yeah. Overall, I mean, I think this episode looked really good. I mean, I'm not one to harp on, I don't like to harp on 3D. I think they're doing a great job here. This looks really good to me. He runs up and his plan is that he's going to use his rooster shout to break some boulders off the side of a cliff and create like a dam, which he does do. And it kind of stops the water for a moment, but it's not enough. And the water breaks through his little makeshift dam. And
the whole time the, YouTuber is capturing all this.
Yeah. He's basically become like a photojournalist here.
Yeah, like basically both Elizabeth and the YouTuber are chasing him down, obviously trailing KG, but every time he stops to try to do his plans, the YouTuber's filming him.
Yeah. But he has one last shot. He sees this huge pillar of rock, and so Elizabeth is following behind, and this is like she's seeing how brave he's being in this moment, how selfless he's being, and this is like she kind of has an inner monologue where she like realizes that she actually does love him. She really does love him. And for his final move, KG uses super Kokekokoko. So it's a super version of his move. And this knocks the whole thing over, and it ends up blocking and saving the town. Ibokura is there. He's watching the whole thing, like you said, and he sees this, and he sees this selfless chicken rooster guy do this amazing stuff, and now he vows that I'm going to be a better man. I'm going to be a better person. I'm going to live my life and start over.
He even calls his mom to tell him, basically, Mom, I'm changing it, turning a new leaf. I'm going to do some traveling, some soul searching, and like I think he even apologizes to his mom for some of the stuff he said in the past, I think, but like he's basically saying like time for a new me.
Yeah. Yeah, Kiji's like, you know, we see him briefly here when like the others two catch up to him, and I mean, he's all like bloodied and like barely conscious and stuff. It's like, yeah, it's very Dragon Ball Z in this moment, you know, where he's like recovering from the epic battle.
Yeah, he's actually like really bloody because it makes sense because like some of the boulders hit him during like the explosions and like in the water gushing and whatnot. So he got hit by some rocks and whatnot. He looked pretty bloody at the end of the whole thing. And even when he was doing the final boulder, like he cut it and it didn't sit right, so he had to do it again. I think the second time is when he did the super move, but like, mm-hmm. yeah, he had to do like three or four times to actually get the water to stop, all while taking some damage. But yeah, he was pretty bloody, but then it seemed like the next scene he shaked it all off, which was like, oh, okay. I guess we're just doing the JoJo's thing where you can like lose fingers and then the next 5 minutes they've grown back somehow. But
yeah, so he's like, after all that, he's like sitting there all bloodied up and whatnot. Picoro or Picoyo or whatever her name is starts kissing him.
Pyoko.
And then of course Elizabeth is like, stop, isn't that enough kissing? And they're like kind of having like a chick fight, literally. And
yeah,
I think before like the special credits roll, the last thing he says is like, stop that racket, because he's just sitting there like bleeding out while these two chickens are like just kind of circling him, you know. Do you like him? No, I don't. Are you lying? I think you're lying. Like, not even. He's like bleeding out, people. Stop having, now's not the time for this conversation.
Yeah, I don't think that the Elizabeth Pyoko rivalry is going to end anytime soon, apparently.
I mean, and it's kind of like, it's not super serious, because like, obviously, Elizabeth is a grown-ass woman and Pyoko is a child, so it's not super serious. It's more for jokes and whatnot, but...
But it's not ending.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, but it's definitely, we should elaborate, it's more for jokes than like a serious thing, I guess, but...
No, yeah, it's just...
Yeah, like when Pyoko says that KG, when Pyoko says KG's going to be her husband, it's not like
That's just like a little kid thinking.
Take that at face value,
right? I'm just saying there are shows that would be serious about that, and that'd be a big problem. But we just elaborate that the show's not being serious.
No, it's not. No. I mean, and every time Elizabeth's like this kid, you know, that kind of thing. There was a brief scene where we see like the townsfolk are cheering and relieved, and the little girl's relieved, and she's like, "Thank you, Pyoko. Thank you, Elizabeth. Thank you, Mr. Rooster." You know, because she didn't even know KG's name.
Also, during the whole sequence here, you mentioned earlier how, and even last episode, how these like townspeople are very accepting of, you know, all of this. And like, they even mentioned like, oh, it's the rooster that we've seen before that has like special powers. Go rooster. Like they just accept this.
They just
magic
accept
rooster
it.
Is going to blow down this mountain.
I mean, the options is either that or die, right?
Die. So. Yeah. It's fine.
But where is that one person? Someone, there's got to be a person who's going to eventually be like, what is going on here? I don't think so. I don't think the show operates that way.
And they've established, you know, when they saw the demon attacking the dam, or they thought it was attacking the dam, like we've established that there are like demons are like a known quantity now. Like people, I guess, are just aware that demons exist and they've been showing up. So there's like no one's surprised that like there's a demon around. Like maybe they're not commonplace, but they just say like, oh, it's a demon. So so maybe that makes them more accepting that there's also powerful chickens.
that's where the disconnect happens for me. Okay, I can understand. I've seen enough shows where there are demons and monsters. Okay, I'm okay with that. The chickens being heroes is like a new weird thing that's separate.
That's strange. Your suspension of disbelief, not the demons, the chickens.
Yeah. Absolutely, because I've seen too many other shows and stories with demons, but I've never seen one with heroic chickens that apparently can use smartphones. That's where it goes across the line for me, but I'm okay with it. I'm just saying it's goofy that nobody seems like obsessed about that. That's all. Anyway, a final scene in, like I said, like a kind of like a twist. Morio ends up surviving from drowning. He did not drown. He actually crawls out of the water, and he has like a little moment here. He's like, "I lived. I'm finally alive." And then
I will mention that he does talk. He does talk of KG. Like KG and crew assume that Morio died, and then Morio pops back up, and then he's talking like, "Oh, you're alive. Oh, you helped."
Oh,
me
that's
help
right.
Each
they
other.
Did.
Oh.
They did see each other. Yeah.
Yeah. This is basically like the end of a Pokemon episode, where it's like, "We'll see each other again." For sure. Next time.
Narrator.
It's definitely happening.
Yeah. Well, to be fair, in Pokemon, there was a few times where Ash like looped back and saw some of the trainers and whatnot. You see that. So that happened a few times, but
yeah, it just kind of feels like every Pokemon episode ends with him. Like he meets someone, they do a thing, and then he leaves and he's like, "See you later."
Yep. And as they separate, we see a mysterious woman with green eyes comes walking up to Morio, and she's got long hair and she's got like a black pantsuit on. She just walks up to him and he's like, "Huh?" And he looks at her, and then her finger turns into like a drill and she just like stabs him right in the forehead and kills him. And that's the end of the episode. So this is like a new villain has appeared.
It's a very Fist of North Star style kill with the poke to the forehead and into death.
Now, have we seen this person before? Like, not, I think she might be in the opening briefly.
In the opening, maybe.
So, yeah, I also make a comment. I think it might have been Hellwarden, but someone who's made a comment in the thread, like, I wonder when we see the humans or the human like people in the opening. He said this before, or they said this before the episode started, and lo and behold, that he jinxed Morio and got him killed.
Now, I'm of the mind right now that this is not a human, that this is probably just a new form of demon.
Yeah, she like transformed her finger into like a tendril spike thing, like you said. So definitely not just a normal human.
Yeah.
So we'll
see, but like I'm inclined to agree that there's something not quite right of this person.
All right. And so that's this episode. I thought it was a pretty good episode. I liked it. The show continues to be entertaining to watch. The animation was good. There was a scene I didn't mention briefly where it's revealed why KG came back, because remember he was doing his loner thing, and then I guess When he learned that there was a flood, he actually got worried about Elizabeth and Piyoko and decided to go find them. So that's what led him to the dam.
He'll never admit that out loud, but we just saw his thoughts in that flashback. So like, but clearly that makes sense. If he's the type of guy who's going to risk his life to save the townsfolk, he'd be the type of guy to be worried about his friends in a flood. So
he's a good guy. He's just gruff and has a hard exterior, and that's good. Yeah. And otherwise I really like this episode.
The classic jerk of heart of gold archetype.
Okay. Well, that's it for Rooster Fighter. Let's move on to the next episode, which is, of course, Don to Don. Don to Don, Season 2, Episode 4. That's, like, way deadly.
Now, I don't know about you guys, but this episode went exactly like I predicted.
Are you being sarcastic?
I'm joking. This episode has some twists and turns.
I'm curious what you predicted, though, but we can come back to that.
That was a joke. It was just that this episode has a lot of unexpected reunions and reprisals of characters that
everyone is here, just
old
Sakura, everyone's here.
And I know
Ira's not here, but everyone else is here.
I don't want to sound like a broken record, but I mean this is an amazing episode of Don to Don and probably my favorite so far this season. It's really great. Let's go over it real quick here. Momo figures out the true legend. So basically, she's arguing with the Kito woman about what's going on, and she's kind of realizing that, what the priest guy said, was more accurate than what the Kitos believe. And then she comes up with this plan that she's going to use the worm to put out the fires and stop the lava by like plugging up the spring and using it like a hose.
Yeah, it's like a giant fire hose.
Yeah,
I think we should just elaborate that the legend was just a matter of, I think that there's a lot of volcanic activity that's preluded by heightened geyser activity rather than the serpent somehow controlling the volcano, just to be clear about what that legend meant.
To be honest, until you just said that, I wasn't 100% sure what they were talking about. Now that you've said that, I understand it. So
yeah, the Kitos believe they had to make sacrifices to the worm to keep the eruptions from occurring.
No, I get it.
It's a very volcanic area, and you see hot springs near volcanoes for obvious reasons pretty frequently. But just like if there's really heightened geyser activity, that's a prelude to a potential eruption, something of that sort. So we kind of got teases of that, of geysers activity like earlier in previous episodes. And so it's just coincidence that the volcano erupted now when a serpent happened to die.
While she's trying to do this, unfortunately, the Kitos are still being jerks and they're attacking Momo, and she's not able to do both things at the same time.
It's actually kind of like Looney Tunes or even Scooby-Doo here, where she's just like running with the worm and kind of like even some silly sound effects where she's just like, leave me alone. I'm trying to put out the fire. And obviously it's very serious and very energetic, but there's also just a little bit of goofiness while they're like, these Kitos are trying to stop her while she's just kind of zooming around with this worm.
When she's running though, with the worm through the town, like the animation.
Yes. It's
in this segment was especially good. Like it was so dynamic and amazing looking.
Something that that's funny to me is that I remember Momo mentioning in I think last season how she's like, oh, I'm not a good runner, I'm not super athletic and whatnot. And I'm looking at this and I'm thinking to myself, she has the stamina and speed of Olympian. Well, what is she fucking talking about? She's like running across town at top speed, carrying like a giant, using her psychic powers to carry things, but it's still like heavy, it's still a burden on her, and she's running with her just leg strength and her stamina. Like, she should just...
It's all adrenaline.
Yeah, she should join the Japanese Olympics team. Like, Christ.
She's also young too. So.
Well, yes, but like that's there's young and there's
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, she's definitely underselling her abilities. She's amazing. She's one of the best parts of the show because of the fact that she is so capable. Anyway, as capable as she is getting beat down by the grandma. But that's when the priest guy that she ran into in the earlier has shown up again, and he comes in with a flying kick, and he's got skills.
Yeah, he's got like top-notch karate type like martial arts.
Yeah. And we end up learning in this scene that he isn't just some random priest of this town. He's actually Seiko's student. He gives her a call, or it was her that called him to tell her.
It kind of plays. So like from his perspective, Seiko like has like a literally like a 10-second phone call or maybe even less with him. And I forget exactly what you said, but it's like a very, very quick like message or warning like, hey, someone's going to come and you got to, you know, do this. Bye. And so like a very quick kind of vague phone call. And he calls her out on this later. Like, you weren't clear enough about what I should be expecting here.
Yeah.
Basically, he was telling them that that Momo and her friends were coming over, and he didn't realize that the woman he met at the when she came to see the quote unquote Tsukinochi and whatnot was the woman he was supposed to expect. So he's just like was kind of in the dark and only like just figured it out now to do his dynamic entry and whatnot.
Well, he does stop the Kito for a moment, but it's everything. The whole situation changes when Gigi, aka the evil eye, shows up, and he's attacking everybody, and now he's doing such incredible damage that Momo, the Kitos, and the priest all decide that they have no choice. They don't want to, but they're going to have to team up against Gigi here.
I think it was mostly the Kito mom, the matriarch. Yeah. I think the rest of the Kitos were kind of like, you know, like knocked out or something. They were kind of off the
side. She's like the only one that really matters.
Yeah. Yeah, she's the main character of them.
But still, it's like a, you know, kind of a, you know, it's a unexpected, like not fully in sync team up here, but it's kind of like, hey, we have to put our own conflict aside for now. We got to deal with this thing.
Enemy of my enemy and all that stuff.
Well, they fight, but Gigi's, I keep saying Gigi, the evil eye is so powerful. He is knocking them out. You know, he's doing serious damage here. It doesn't seem like they're kind of holding themselves, but they're not enough. But then reinforcements show up. The first one out of the blue is the Mentesian, the guy who kind of looks like a lobster guy from season one.
Shrimp.
He shows up, starts doing his boxing stuff, and is like doing some serious damage. And then they look up in the sky, and his UFO is up there, being piloted by his son, and coming down from the UFO, we see both Seiko and Taro the mannequin are there, and they're dropping in as well.
Just like I expected.
Yeah, the commercial break, and yeah, it's like, yeah, holy crap, everybody's here.
Except Ira.
Sorry. And then I just wrote down, epic battle ensues, because I'm not going to be able to do it justice.
Yeah, I mean, Seiko swings her bat at Gigi, so they trade some blows. The Mentesian trades some blows. And I think Taro does his, like, charging run. And then, at the meantime, the priest is doing a prayer, because Seiko tells him, start your chanting, because they're about to set a trap for the Evil Eye. And, of course, Evil Eye obliterates Taro with one punch. But what happens is that his pieces disassemble, and then because he had a seal on the inside of his body, and then Taro's chant activates it, and it traps the Evil Eye, and then basically paralyzing him, and catching him like we talked about Pokemon. Well, that was last show, but talking about Pokemon, he got captured like a Pokeball was thrown at him, basically.
Yeah, and they win. The team up works, and they win, and they defeat the Evil Eye. Oh, by the way, the kid who's piloting the UFO this whole episode is basically like singing to himself out loud through the loudspeaker. And it's very cute. But anyway, Momo goes to try to save. He's like, oh, I got to go save Okarun. I promised him I'd be back. She gets there and then sees that the lava has plugged up the hole leading to the underground.
It's just a field of lava. The whole cavern is submerged in molten. Yeah. Yeah.
So she kind of breaks down and thinks that
very, very. A very dramatic moment here. Like,
yeah, I'm not going to undersell this.
Yeah, I can't believe this is happening.
As far as they're concerned, like, Okarun basically just got cooked. So, like, literally, and she was about to jump in to go after him, and then the Mentesian had to hold her back. Like, no, don't sacrifice yourself. That's always not going to accomplish anything. I think they sense some kind of like concretion within the lava, and then they're able to use a tractor beam to extract it. And then they also do some worm goo, and then we eventually it's revealed that what happened is that the section in which Okarun and Turbo Granny were trapped, and I was covered in the worms, whatever it was, goop or saliva or whatever it is that trapped them. It encased them and protected them from the lava, so they didn't get they got burned, but they didn't get like literally their bones melted off by lava. They didn't get cooked alive, just some minor burns.
Yeah, like Momo was really, and before that, Momo was very, very sad that because she wasn't able to keep her promise to Okarun. She felt very guilty about it. But then when she sees it,
she was distraught. I mean,
oh yeah, absolutely.
Anyone would be. So
on many levels too, because I think she has real feelings for him, of course. So anyway, when she sees him alive, he's like, first Turbo Granny walks out and she just, her Turbo Granny thing.
Just like, I totally forgot about you.
Yes, she did say that.
Yeah, Momo forgot about Turbo Granny. Yeah,
that's what I meant. Yeah, like, oh yeah, Turbo Granny's there too.
Yeah, but anyway, Okarun kind of stumbles out and he ends up falling like into Momo here accidentally, and does kind of like a blush thing where he's like, oh, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to do that. I didn't mean to wrap my arms around you. And he stands up, but then the episode ends with Momo kind of walking up to him and deliberately putting her face on his chest and giving him a hug.
She has no time for these anime tropes. She's just like, her man didn't burn to death. She's just fucking happy. That's it. That's all she cares about. No anime trope nonsense. I'm just happy my man is alive.
Now, she would never do that anyway. I mean, that's the thing I like about her character. I don't think she would do that. I think that's what I like. But more importantly, she without words makes it clear to him that was fine that he did that. And also I was so emotionally drained and so emotionally relieved to see you alive that I'm just going to come up and do the same to you. It was a nice moment. And that's the end of the episode. I think when I was taking notes during this episode, I kind of missed the part, and I'm glad you described it, when Gigi was like pokeballed or whatever, or the evil eye or whatever.
Yeah, basically, there's the big battle, which is, of course, well, extremely well animated, mostly with Seiko. But just very, very briefly, one of the Seiko's kind of commands was just to have Taro basically run, dash straight at Gigi. Gigi just punches him. He shatters and kind of collects immediately, like surrounds, basically gets captured. Gigi gets captured by the mannequin.
Gotcha.
Yeah,
there's even that joke where the mannequin has saying like, where am I gonna move my organs, there's no room for them, and say,
oh, that's what that was about. Okay, I did catch that, where he's holding his like internal organs.
Yeah, so they really haven't like now, so it's not everything is good and dandy now. They have to figure out, okay, Gigi is now possessed by the evil eye inside of Taro. How do we like separate Gigi from the eye?
I don't know how one defines necessarily the division of arcs in the show. I'm sure there's some debate, but I'll just say I don't consider this arc over yet, because they do actually spend some number of episodes dealing with this fallout, and it takes like a number of episodes for it to like work itself out. So I don't consider this arc over, which is kind of what I meant by when I part said that this goes on for a while. We still need to resolve stuff, and this takes a few episodes.
All right. Well, before we move on to Blue Lock, do you guys have anything else you want to say about this episode?
I'm sure we could see nominees this battle for best fight. I think that's...
Yeah, we can.
And maybe the moment where like Momo kind of sees that Okun's alive again, and that hug, that transition to ending. Maybe that could be a moment. And there's just a lot of nominatable stuff from this episode, I feel.
Mm-hmm. For sure.
I have one comment that's a little bit personal. I've actually been in the situation where it wasn't like a romantic situation, but someone that I knew, I thought might be dead, and then it turns out they weren't. And definitely in those moments, like, all you want to do is hug them.
Yeah.
Like, that's just natural. It would be weird if that didn't happen, I think.
No, I think a lesser show would have been the, oh, they touch inappropriately when they didn't mean to, anime hijinks. Oh, like, a lesser show would have done that. Which is what they were setting up, but they're like, no, I actually am a confident writer. Yeah, I'm not going to fucking do that, so.
Yeah, I agree with you, and I'm not saying this was wrong or whatever. I'm just like, that is what should have happened, and it is.
Yeah.
They hugged. They should have, and they did. So.
Yeah, great episode. Okay, let's move on to Blue Lock. Blue Lock, Episode 11, The Final Piece. In this case, we're referring to Isagi's final piece of the puzzle, which there was a lot of puzzle imagery in this episode. So the game is still going on, but ultimately what happens is that Isagi awakens to his ability, the thing he's been searching for this whole time. He has what's called the direct shot. They literally call it this, the direct shot. And this is his, what do they call it? Everybody has their weapon. Is that it?
They call it awakening, I think.
Yeah. Or his awakened weapon.
They have like their weapons, but they also call like their awakened like state.
Yeah.
Kind of use both of these.
And their monster and their all sorts of random words to sound unnecessarily cool.
Yeah. I'm just going to be honest. The sequence was fun, how they get like this big dramatic goal to win the match, but trying to like the logic behind like how the puzzle works and what he figured out and why this works now and it didn't work before. And I'm just I kind of lost me a little bit. I'm just like, yeah, just shoot the score. Shoot the shot and score a goal.
Yeah, the solution is take the shot, dipshit.
Yeah.
Yeah, there was more to it than that in the episode, but I'll agree with you that I was like, whatever. It's just hit the ball into the net. But he does it and wins. So yeah, they defeat the other team.
And to be clear, like this whole sequence is like pretty long, like 5 to 7 minutes. Yeah. And this is all like before the opening also. Like it was a late opening in this episode. And like all the different players, or at least the main players on the team, like are all like really, you know, dramatic, intense in this whole moment. Obviously, this is kind of like all comes down to this sort of deal. So a lot of Isagi vocalizing and kind of yelling at himself and kind of like really intense in the voice performance here. Very
also mentioned there was some sick usage of impact frames when they actually did.
Oh, yes.
When he actually took the shot, that was actually a pretty spectacular short bit of animation there.
Yep. And they win. And so my notes here say, I'm going to go over this. You guys can comment, but I'll say that, Kuon is there, of course. The first thing that happens is that Bakugo walks up and just punches Kuon in the face.
No, actually, the first thing that happens, I think the orange-haired guy or a few others were trying, like, Kuon, come on over. You celebrate. You were part of the you were part of the team. Like, everyone was, like, going to do the full forgiveness. And not Bakugo was like, hold up. I got to get my punch in because fuck this motherfucker.
Yep, Bakugo punches him. And then my next note is forgiven question mark.
Well, it was kind of I have in my notes that it was like a sucker punch. He like offers his hand, Bakugo, Raigo, whatever his name is. And then like Kuon goes to grab it and then he punches him. So it's kind of like a sucker punch,
go ahead.
All I was going to say was, it was like, he didn't just come up to him and punch him. It was sort of just like, it was almost like a gotcha, like, you know, come with us. I'm going to put out my hand and then I'm going to punch you.
I would say that Bakugo is still very much in the not fully, Kuon is not fully forgiven from Bakugo's perspective. I think that's very much true. I do think the most of the other guys are probably just like, are not going to bring up the betrayal for the rest of their
probably
season. I think Bakugo will keep bringing up, but I don't think anyone else did. I think everyone else is like good now, which is
the other thing that Bakugo says though, when he walks away, he's like, I guess it's all right. He says something like that, where it's like he's not fully forgiving him, but he is somewhat forgiving him.
Right, as opposed to everyone else is just like, yeah, you can be the best man at my wedding. Here's my social security.
Yes, which is, again, what's the thing I was afraid would happen, and yeah, it's annoying. Anyway, okay, so they've won. There's a bit with the celebration party, and they're kind of getting ready to celebrate their win and their success. They do see, though, that another player is kind of standing nearby. It's Nico, the guy from Team Y, and he's also, even though his team lost, he has survived.
Yeah, the guy with the partially covered hair, of course, his hair covers his face partially, right?
Yeah, and my thought in this moment was, I have no memory of this guy.
You know, the guy who Isagi, like, I think, was like, I drink your milkshake, and we saw him start crying on the field, the Nico guy, because he was the guy who was, like, doing all the planning, and I think a previous, he was one of the few characters from that team that had a, like, somewhat unique design or just slight distinctive. But I think as they were celebrating, they were doing, highlighting that there are other teams who are doing Walk of Shame, and people were, like walking out in the hallway, making noise, and, like, leaving Blue Lock, but of course, the higher scores from the other teams survived, so it was Nico, that kingly guy who Isagi trained with like by accident a couple episodes back, he survived. And I think they mentioned one other guy whose name I don't remember survived. But everyone else from the other teams kind of supposed to be kicked out, because I think it was Team Z, the good guy team, and then the team they just played with Nagi and the rich kid and the guy who think he's tried to come up smarter as he is. Those two, they survived as well, that whole team and Z team. Yeah. And I think it was supposed to be only three other players from the other teams that survived, like one from each other team.
Yeah, and I remember, Nico, in that Team Y game, there was like only two characters on that team that mattered. There was like the scorer and then like the tactics guy, and Nico was the
tactics guy. Oh, the tactics guy. Okay, yeah. I do remember him now.
And but Nico even mentions here, like, you know, hey, our match that you won, like, it taught me a lesson that I needed to be a better striker, and Nico kind of took over as like the main scorer, which is why he survived. Like, this is kind of done off screen, but he must have scored enough goals on his team that he will stick around, that King guy will stick around, and then someone from Team W or whatever will also stick around. So there's going to be three characters that stick around.
Yeah. Allegedly. I'm a little confused by what happens at the end of the episode.
Yeah, I'm a little confused. Yeah,
we'll get to that in a second. I've got things to say. But okay, so that's when the commercial break happens. When we come back, Ego comes onto the screen. And he says, okay, by the way, in this whole segment, for the rest of the episode, Isagi has, like, a hunger. And he's just like, I need to get the ball. I need to kick a ball. Like, he's just, like, obsessed now.
He wants balls.
He wants balls really bad. Ego comes on and he says, okay, before we go to the next selection, and I know where you guys, I know this isn't true, but I'm just going to say what the episode said. Ego comes on and he says, the other sections of Blue Lock, the other four sections, which are all higher ranked than you, they are still doing their stuff. So for now, you need to work on strength training, and you have to do that while they continue to finish out their stuff. And he even shows like a picture that like they're using like advanced VR training stuff and stuff like that, that the lower groups weren't getting. This is what Ego says. And so we see a little brief montage of you know, building five people, particularly our main team Z, are all doing the strength training and being worn out. And when they finally get done with some of that, and I guess it's been days or whatever.
I think it's like 9 or 10 days they do the strength training.
Yeah. When they come back in, Ego comes back on the screen and he's like, psych! Actually, there's only building five. The other four buildings aren't even, there are no players. It's just you guys. I lied to you.
So when they have those rankings of 250 people, they're only like 50 people in Blue Lock then? Is that what he's basically saying?
Exactly. He says it was all a ruse to make you fear that you were at the lowest rung so that you would fight harder.
Well, did any teams get eliminated then? Or like...
No, it was all fake.
Then who were all the people crying and left, leaving?
Yeah, did those people get eliminated or not? Because like, I'm like...
Yes. The people in Building 5, some people in Building 5 got eliminated. Teams in Building 5 did.
So, like, if there are two teams of 11, 22, and then 20, and then three other kids, but then, so that would be, what, 25 contestants? But then we saw, like, a new kid who was not in any of the other teams, I think, who, like, was super well at kicking the balls. Like, where did that come from? It seems like there's more than 25 people there. I'm just not sure how many people are left and who did or didn't get kicked out, or did anyone get kicked out, or, like, what the fuck is going on, honestly?
Well, yeah, I'm a little confused with this too.
The way I took it was that there were more than two teams in Block 5, and the other than Team Y, no, not Y, the one that the last team they played, whichever letter that was.
I think V. I think Eagle said teams V and Z, or like whoever their last team they fought, and then the protagonist team survived, and then three other people survived is what he said, right, which would be 25
people. But my point is those two teams survived, a couple of other people from the other team survived, but those other people on those other teams did not survive.
Right,
but where did this new character come from? Like, what team was he on?
He wouldn't be on it, wouldn't be anyone else left, because that would only be 25 people in total, and there's definitely more than 25 people in that room, right? When they all met together.
This is what I was confused about. So, like, none of the other buildings exist. There's two teams of 11. That's 11 plus 11. And then there's the three other people that survived. So that's how you get to 25. And it's just like, where did this other guy come from? This greenish.
No. What I'm saying is that those three other guys all were from teams. There's more than 25 players. There were five teams in building five.
Yeah, but three of them got eliminated except for one character each. Only two surviving teams, according to what Eagle said initially.
Right.
So that's 25. Team B and Team W. Or Team B and Team Z.
And we saw the rest of those teams leaving.
Right. Yeah, that's what I'm also confused about this.
So that should only be 25 people left, but it's clearly more than 25 people left. And then this person who was doing this good kicking. Well,
why do you keep saying that? Why do you say that there's more than 25 people left?
Where did this new character come from? What team was he on?
He was on a team we probably didn't see from Building 5.
But I thought those teams didn't exist.
No, the teams that were in Building 1, 2, 3, and 4 didn't exist.
Those don't exist.
Right. So but there were more than two teams in Building 5 is what I'm saying.
How many teams were in Building 5?
I think there were five teams in Building 5.
Right.
I feel really dumb here because, okay, there are five teams. There's Team B, which we just saw, and this new character was not on that team. There was Team... I actually have a list here. There was Team W that they beat earlier, and he wasn't on that team. There was Team X, which they beat earlier, and he wasn't on that team. There was Team Y, which they beat earlier, and he wasn't on that team. Or maybe they lost one of these teams, I forget. And then there's Team Z. Like, we've seen all five of these teams, and this new character was not on any of them. Like, where did he come from?
I don't know about the new character. I kind of forgot he existed. I don't know. Yeah. Maybe he's just Ego is inserting this guy. I don't know where he came from.
But also, like, even if you look in the room where they all gather, there's definitely more than 25 people in that room.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know that. That could just be bad animation. I have no idea.
The show's not helping. This is very confusing. Like,
let me read something real quick here. I'm curious. This episode's called, okay, Crocodile's got to head out. We'll try to figure this out for you, Crocodile. I don't know. I wanted to look up real quick what the wiki says about this episode. So Seda has posted a link to this new character.
He was shown at the end of the episode.
Okay, here's what the wiki says. Ego shows up and notes that they've noticed that there are no players from Building 1 through 4. The reason is that only Building 5 exists. Ego explains that they all believe that they're at the bottom of the pile in the first selection. It was a ruse to break up their half-baked confidence. So,
I think I may understand. Okay, I don't think this is the way this was explained. Maybe it's a dub thing, but I think. There are five buildings, but
yes,
every building was labeled as number five.
No, I'm seeing a picture of it right here. They were the buildings are labeled 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, but only Building 5 had people in it.
Okay.
That's what it is.
So where did all these other people that we've never seen before come from?
What do you mean? I don't know. I thought there's only one character we didn't know.
Well, but like Crocodile was saying, when they show like all the characters in that room, there's like a bunch.
That scene is, I'm not sure about. I thought that those were from like a team that we didn't see that was in Building 5 that we just never saw a match with them.
Saw all them. We saw all five teams in Building 5. So like, there should be
maybe we're unsure about how many teams are in Building 5. I don't know. That might be the problem.
I thought there were five teams in each building was the original description.
That's what I thought too.
And then it's like, okay, if the four buildings don't actually exist, then 20 of those teams don't exist, and then it's just the five that we already know.
Right. I'm going back a little bit here because now I really want to know how many people are in each block. I'm going back here to like episode one. He explains that Blue Lock Facility has 25 teams from B to Z, mm-hmm. who are split into five groups in five buildings.
Right.
Each team lost one player. So, okay.
That part doesn't matter. But yeah, so okay, there's five teams in each building. So 25.
Correct.
But four of the buildings apparently don't exist. So 20 of the teams don't exist.
Yeah. So, but the only part that's weird is that we saw more than one character in that final scene, I guess, that weren't shown before, but if you think about it, everyone from Team Y except Frilly Hair Guy was leaving. So he would have, those people would have been the ones walking out, right?
Yeah.
I guess I just don't know where these other characters came from.
That's basically the confusion is like, okay, we've seen all five teams, so we should know all the characters, but then like there's one new character who's clearly like named and important, and then there's just a bunch of other new people there, and it's just kind of like, that's the main confusion. It's like, okay, if the other buildings don't exist, then where did these people come from? Because we haven't seen them before. It'd be like gaining a brother in your house that you never saw before. Like, wait, where did you come from? So like there are no other buildings. That's what we're told. The thing that I don't know if this is fan fiction or not, but were all five buildings just told that they were all the worst? So like everyone.
No, there was never. There was only five? One. There was only one building. There was only one.
Yeah.
Building.
So that's. I'm just. That's why I'm. I'm just. I'm. I'm even on this character's page, and I'm trying to say like it doesn't say what team he was on. It's yeah. I'm confused.
No, again, I do believe Blue Lock is like a Pentagon-style building and that there are five rooms in it, because we're seeing, at the end of the episode, we see Isagi go into the next room, right? He's, I guess, leaving in to go to the next block. But apparently, I think the other four building blocks are just going to be part of some huge test. There weren't players in them. He does, I mean, it does say here that the reason that there's no players in buildings 1-4 is that only building 5 exists, is what he says. So if I take this literally as it's written in this fan-made wiki, then he's saying that only the 5th building exists. But I don't know if they mean that by players or they mean literally building. I don't know. It is confusing. You guys, you made a good point here. I am confused as well.
Yeah.
I think I took it that there were enough players from the teams that lost in Building 5 to constitute that group that was leaving. I guess I don't remember that scene showing other people we haven't seen before.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm actually capturing an image here real quick that I think might illustrate it better than anything else. I know this is an audio podcast. Sorry, our small audience.
No, we can cut this out. That's no big deal. I'd rather look at it and comment on it.
No, I just did this whole section. I feel dumb, but like I feel like it just wasn't explained well. I'm going to blame Ego on this one.
Well, I mean, I think I understood everything except when you guys said you saw people you didn't recognize. But everything else made sense to me. That Ego lied to them about there being 25 teams.
I'm you know, obviously risking spoilers, but apparently they eventually get like team names after colors and or something.
Oh, really? Okay. Oh, maybe I should read this. I just searched, and on Reddit, on the Blue Lock subreddit, there's a post called Episode 11 Confusion. Here's what it says. Hold on. Ego just mentioned that there were never any other buildings at Blue Lock except Building 5, and that it was just a bluff. There are literally 5 teams in the room, which adds up to 55 players. There's no way only 55 people entered Blue Lock, so I'm just confused now. And this is what the highest ranked response says this. There are 5 buildings in Blue Lock. In the beginning, they were told that were teams B through Z, but actually each building had teams V through Z.
Okay, this is what I was wondering, is there were 5 other teams in each of the buildings, but they were all told that they were the worst. So there are other people in those buildings, and what Ego said is, they're like, in a sense, they're all Building 5. That's the only thing that makes sense to me.
That's not Let me read it.
They're all V through Z. So there's like 5 team Bs, 5 team Ws.
What? Oh, but actually, each building had teams V through Z. Oh, yeah, I guess V through Z.
That's what I was guessing.
I guess you're right. Yeah, I'm starting to see what you're saying now. So you're saying there was a duplicate team, there were 4 other team Zs?
Yeah.
Oh.
They were all told they were, so like, Ego's explanation that there were no other buildings isn't quite right. It's like, they're all Building 5. Like, they were all told that they were Building 5.
Oh, this makes so much, okay, yes, this answers the question. So, and then they go on to say, so when they all meet up in the middle, there are 10 teams inside the room. Two winners from each of the 5 buildings. Okay. That's the answer.
Yeah. So Ego's explanation that
is all bad.
The other buildings don't exist is like wrong.
It's flat. Yeah, that's plainly the wrong way to explain that. He should have said there's no team B through whatever. That's what he should have said. He said he should have just said there were five team Z's, five team V's. Yeah, okay. All right. I'm glad we went through that ordeal because now at least I understand what the hell's going on.
Yeah.
So that's why we have these other people. These people were probably from teams V through Z in the other buildings, right? Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So this is my assumption is that everyone was basically told, you suck. You're the lowest of the low.
Right.
And he's trying to, this is like all a ploy to get people to like, you know, have that drive to do better or whatnot. Because I guess that makes sense. If you were told you were the best, you're like, oh, I'm the best. Right? So
this means that when Ego said everybody has to do strength training, it was everybody doing strength training. That was
yes.
In all five buildings. Okay. And yeah, I'll tell you, how do I feel about this? I guess I'm okay with this, other than I thought my idea of what was a little more interesting, that he had tricked them in thinking they were that there were other teams and there weren't. But I guess this is different. I guess it's all right. Whatever.
I think the main problem is just Ego's explanation was bad. And I don't know, was that just a dub thing? Or
well, that's what this guy's inferring. In this Reddit post, they said that the anime dub is maybe making it confusing. So
like maybe if you were to read it in Japanese, understanding Japanese, the explanation was better.
Maybe.
So, I finally got my image to work a little bit late, but like these are the five teams
Okay.
These are the five teams that we knew. And like, right. Like if those are the only characters that we knew, like there should be no one else. This is everyone, but we now know
right.
that's not the case.
Yeah, there were definitely people from the other buildings. Okay.
Yeah. So.
Wow. Terrible job, Ego. You're doing a bad job, Ego.
And I don't know if the episode also hinted at this, like the rankings that they were given. Like I forget what Isagi's ranking number is or whatever, 275 or whatever. Like there's probably people with like duplicate rankings because they were.
I guess. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh no! Wait. There was a guy, you know what? I just picked up on this. When they're watching the guys leaving, I think he saw a number on the guy's shoulder pad. And maybe it was like his number or someone similar to his number.
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah, that's ringing a bell now. Okay.
Yeah, so basically it comes down to that Ego's explanation is wrong. And it might have been a dub thing.
Yeah. Yeah, I was way off. I took him literally. And I shouldn't have done that, I guess. Okay. Anything else about Blue Lock?
So, while I'm here, I feel like we're roughly halfway through the first season, so I expect we'll get a new opening soon.
Oh, yeah, hopefully. I think the one they have now is bad.
Yeah.
I don't like it at all. I think it's a bad song. I think the animation is lazy. I don't like it. So, I look forward to a potentially better one. All right. Oh, the one thing they did do in this episode, the last thing I'll mention is they did kind of do an interesting bit with the end credits where like,
oh yeah,
transitioned into it. Yeah.
Yeah. Basically, Isagi is kind of taking charge as the protagonist guy.
Yep. All right. Well, that's Blue Lock. We figured it out. No thanks to Ego. So let's move on to Tokyo Revengers. Tokyo Revengers, Episode 11, Respect. As the gangs, the ambulance and stuff is on the way, so the gangs hear the sirens and stuff, and they all start to flee. And this is when, right before he leaves, Hanma turns back to Mikey, and he says, "My name is whatever Hanma, and I just want you to know that I'm forming the most powerful gang there is, Valhalla."
He does say specifically biker gang. Which I don't know if that's I don't know if that is an important qualifier, but he does call them a biker gang.
I guess these are all biker gangs. I didn't really think they were, but now maybe they are.
That's why I bring it up, is he specifically called them a biker gang. And yeah. like, wait, but like Tanma doesn't, or they don't, Tokyo Manji doesn't call themselves a biker gang, but they do have people on bikes. So
yeah, I think at this point they didn't do a good job of explaining that, but I think as there's enough evidence to infer that they are quote unquote a biker gang.
And he, Hanma, which we've kind of talked about, he just kind of came out of nowhere and he's apparently powerful enough to like, you know, go toe to toe with Mikey, who is beating yeah. everyone else. He even says, like, as Valhalla's first vice commander, blah, 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 says, like, oh, okay, so that means he's a big shot of this Valhalla gang, but there's a bigger shot there, too, that we'll eventually meet, I'm sure.
Yeah, I'm still waiting in on it to be that guy that was shown in, like, episode 3 or whatever.
Oh, yeah.
Anyway, Draken is taken to the hospital, but he's in cardiac arrest. So he's to go to the emergency room. Everyone meets up there. They're all worried. Mikey shows up. Mikey's putting on a real strong face here. And he's just like, it's all right. Just, you know, stay strong. Draken wouldn't die on me. He's too, you know, he's too much of a man. That won't happen. He promised me.
He's not even like nonchalant about it. He's just being very like, he's being very leaderly in terms of just like, you know, confidence in terms of he'll be okay. Draken won't die. Also, this is a hospital, keep your voice down type of thing.
Yeah.
He's being respectful. But I'll jump ahead a little bit here. We learn later that this was just him putting on a face, really. Like, he was internally distraught also about all of this. We see him later like breaking down and cry, which is like, you know, the first time we've seen him show that sort of emotion. So how do I put this? I think this shows that there is some depth to his character and that like he can put on this mask as the leader, as like someone who is like a pillar of like support and confidence for his team and his gang or his whatever. But like internally, he's like really, really like also very worried about Draken here.
Yeah, that was the best scene in the episode to me when when Takemichi finds Mikey crying by himself. He doesn't let Mikey know that he's watching out of respect. But yeah, it's like Mikey's basically crying. He's like, Draken, how could you do that? You almost died. I can't believe it. You know, he's just like, in the side of him, he would never show anyone, which is, yeah, I like Mikey a lot. He's doing the right things. He's being a good guy. That was a really nice scene. But anyway, Draken lived. And
There's also a scene here where the silver haired guy is talking to Peh about like Draken.
Yeah.
And I don't necessarily like how this was like framed as like a complete like flashback that we didn't see this before, like kind of like a after the fact sort of like revelation. But we know that Peh was upset at Draken, but this silver haired guy whose name I forget is like, hey, just so you know, Draken went with Pa's parents. You know, every time or whenever they went, he went with them to visit Pa, even though he wasn't able to attend. And kind of like I don't necessarily like how we didn't get to see this before. We have to be told about it after the fact, but it whatever, it's fine. We get to learn that Draken is, you know, there's this side of him that he maybe felt guilty or he felt responsible or maybe he just felt like he was obligated or he felt maybe the right thing to do to visit. To visit Pa, even though he wasn't technically allowed to. That's just the kind of person Draken was.
Yeah, and they basically Pa is, even though he did some pretty bad crap in the last couple episodes, they pretty much forgive him.
Yeah. Pa is not really he's kind of a bad character, but they're kind of using him more like he's almost more like a utility character that anyone else, that other characters get to build off of his mistakes.
Yeah, he's there to show that like the Tokyo Manji guys aren't like a bunch of mindless thugs, that they actually have heart and stuff like that. So after the commercial, this is, again, the show starts to dip into trying to do comedy and it doesn't really work for me, but Takemichi's walking around town, he's got goofy clothes on and sunglasses and he's all cocky. And he's strutting around saying, I'm cool shit now.
And he's supposed to be like, when he's like his older self visiting his or embodying his younger self, he's supposed to be more mature. He's not in this moment.
Yeah, actually, in this moment, I thought we were seeing like that Mikey had gone back to the future or Takemichi had gone back to the future and this was his old self again.
Nope.
But no, it's just him being dumb.
Yeah, and it's almost undermining. Like, come on, dude. And even Draken calls him out on this, which is like a score one for Draken. He's like, he doesn't say this, but I could imagine him saying this. He's like, your head's so big. How do you even put on a shirt?
Yeah. He goes to see Draken, who's better now. He's still recovering, but he's up and about a little bit. And he gives he said Mikey left him, he left Takemichi his uniform, his original uniform for Takemichi to wear. So he wants to go thank Mikey. So Draken says, oh, he's up on the roof. So he goes up onto the roof and Takemichi sees Mikey there. And then it's like a kind of a weird scene where Mikey starts to talk like he's like, you know, a lot of stuff happened and it seemed like you knew a lot of things were going to happen. And, you know, almost about like he's just about to call him out on like, are you working for the bad guys? What's your deal? But then he just goes back into like, oh, no, I'm just, you know, just pulling your leg.
I think Mikey does suspect something's up with Takemichi. Obviously, he's not going to think like you went back in time or whatever. That'd be very weird. But Takemichi, yeah. I think Mikey realizes like he's got this sort of insider perception that like, what do you know? Like there's more than to you than you let on. And then he kind of like, to Takemichi's face, he kind of lets it go. But I have a feeling he's not actually letting it go. He's like, I'm going to kind of, to himself, he's like, I'm going to keep an eye on Takemichi and see what's up with this dude. I have a feeling we'll come back to this. I don't think he really let it go.
I agree.
That's just the face he's presenting to Takemichi as, and don't worry about it. It's whatever. But I have a feeling internally he's going to come back to like, what's up with this guy?
Yeah. And I think also it's that as well as like he does genuinely care about the fact that Takemichi saved his best friend. So I think there's a little bit of that too. But I agree. I think that Mikey, I mean, I thought this scene was going to go a different direction, but I think you're right. I think he's just not going to put it all on the table just yet.
Yeah, he's not going to like confront Takemichi and accuse him like, what do you know? He's just going to, you know, like he's kind of just kind of hinting like, maybe to the audience, like a small amount of suspicion. Like he's not oblivious to this. And I'm assuming this will come up later.
So Takemichi's achieved his goal and he's decided that it's now time for him to go back to the future. He goes to Hinata's apartment where she lives with her brother. And he says goodbye to her, which she's kind of confused charm. About. Yeah, gives her like a necklace with like a four-leaf clover. And he says, can you get your brother out here? And then Naoto comes out and he's like, well, you always want to shake my hand. You're so weird, you know, cause he doesn't understand it. And, and then he shakes Naoto's hand and then he is suddenly back into the future, but now he's back at his job, which we had seen before he had lost, but he works there now.
Yeah. There's a bunch of quick clues that stuff has changed. Like he's got his job. He's even going through his phone and like I think Naota's contact isn't there because in this reality he's never met Naota, and things like that. Like clearly stuff has changed. And for a moment he wonders like was that a dream? Did this app actually happen? But then he sees the scar on his hand and he's like, nope, that really happened.
My biggest problem with this part of the episode is like Takemichi takes way too long to believe what he's seeing.
Yeah, like, why would you think it's a dream? Like, that
I don't know.
Like, you spent literally days in the past. Like, that would be a very, I don't know. Like, that wouldn't be my first thought. And I think it's pretty clear that if he's, like, I don't know, he would have enough time to think about this. If you go back in time and you're immediately at your job, I feel like any reasonably intelligent person would be like, wow, things are different now. I must have changed things. And it takes him, like, a couple of minutes to realize this.
It does. It takes him a long time. He's like, why am I in my job? What do you think, dude? Like, it was evident the second we saw you there. And then he goes and meets and he sees Akun became a hairstylist.
And Akun references, like, one of the conversations he had that partially changed the future.
and then, like, Takemichi still in this scene is like, did I do this? It's like, yes, you did this, dude.
And now I guess something that's more of a something that wasn't necessarily expected. And this is something that I think we talked about previously on previous episodes is like how does the time travel affect Naota? Like, would he be aware of changes in the timeline? Because from Naota's perspective, in this case, Hinata's always been alive. Like, Hinata did not die. She's alive. And in this timeline, she has not died, as far as we know. But Naota, sorry, I might have misspoke her name. Hinata has not died. But Naota is aware that there is some other timeline in which she did die. So he retains that, even though in this timeline, Hinata did not die.
Yeah, this is, we've seen this once before, and this is, I think, the concrete proof that this is how it works. Even though Naoto is living in an alternate timeline now, he retains the memory of the fact that it was changed. Because he calls Takemichi on the phone, and he's like, because, and this is another weird thing where Takemichi looks at his phone and is like, I don't recognize this number.
Yeah.
And it's like, I don't know, you've probably called Naoto a lot in your like travels here. I would have thought you'd recognize that by now, but no, maybe not. Anyway, it's Naoto, and he's calling. He's like, it worked. You did it. And this is, and then until this moment is until Takemichi finally admits, oh, I really did all this.
And even, even after he realizes, Naoto says, like, do you want to go meet my sister? And then it's almost like Takemichi forgot, like, oh, yeah, Hinata. That's the whole reason why I did this. She's alive.
I do not. I mean, look, here's the thing. I'm just going to lay it on the line. The way they write Takemichi in this story is bad.
Yeah.
I don't like it. He is a terrible character. Like, because he's a good guy, but he's dumb to the point of being, like, frustrating. And but yet he's smart in some areas, but he's usually just, like, it's just frustrating. It's frustrating to watch a five-minute scene where he can't come to grips with the fact that he did the thing he set out to do.
Yeah, and like he meets with Akun, and like, okay, so he had to have like walked from, he had to like finish his shift at his job, which was awkward maybe because he just kind of
actually
there.
He says he left without checking out.
Oh, I forgot.
He did say that.
And then whatever. he must go to Akun's place, which probably takes a few minutes, talks with Akun, and then he like, I forget where he goes, but like this has got to be like at least dozens of minutes pass here. And apparently he doesn't think about Hinata once.
I know.
Like, I don't know. It's just like, come on, dude.
Yeah.
Like, I can maybe see it not. I would expect it to be the very first thing he thinks about, right? Like, this is his old crush. This is the old thing that he's like been trying to fight for.
He literally just saw her and gave her a necklace.
Yeah.
Like minutes ago from his perspective.
And then he warps to the future and he's like, what was I doing? Come on, dude.
Yeah.
And I don't know if this is more like an anime pacing thing. Like maybe it's better in the manga. I don't think so.
I think it's probably pretty, I bet it's faithful and that Takemichi is just like for the readers. Maybe they think that this is like fun to watch him slowly realize it, but I don't like it. Cause it's like,
here's the most leniency I can give him. Like you're warped through time back to the present. And maybe it takes you like, I don't know, 3 minutes. To like get your bearing, like, whoa, okay. Like I traveled through time. Where am I? What's going on? Like maybe it takes you just like a couple of minutes to kind of just like, you know, reorient yourself. But you would still think like within 5 minutes or like even just I'm being extra lenient here. Within a couple of minutes or less, you should realize these things kind of immediately. I think like Hinata's alive or probably alive. You'd hope, or at least you would check in on that. Like, what's happened with Akun? Yeah. What's happened with, you know, Naota? Like, what are the, you would check in on these things.
Why does he go to Akun first?
Yeah, that's also weird.
Oh, my gosh. What the hell? Yeah, it's just, I don't like the way they write his character in this show. He's kind of the weak point. Anyway. So, but I guess the way we'll finish out talking about this episode is that, like, this has got to be the calm before the storm because everything is too perfect.
Yeah, we're halfway through the season, so, you know, we've kind of finished, you know, the first half big conflict, and now, next episode, I highly doubt Takemichi's going to meet with Hinata, and everything's going to be happily ever after. My prediction is we're going to have, I forget which time travel story this is, or there's probably multiple here, that there's going to be some other tragedy that ultimately ends up probably maybe killing Hinata here. So,
oh, interesting. Then,
or I'm kind of guessing that she dies again, or like it stays dead or something. I don't know. But well, or maybe it's just some other big conflict that arises that like,
yeah,
like I've changed the future, but this current future is not fixed and something else needs to be fixed or something. Like, we know there's going to be another issue.
So
what if Hinata's alive, but she's like an asshole or something? I don't know.
I was going to say that, like, I was going to go dark and be like, what if Hinata is like a prostitute now or something, like,
oh,
like really dark and be like, oh, okay, she's alive, but her life is fucked up. But actually, I don't think they'll go there. But it could also be, we could be leading into one of these scenarios where like, it's a kind of like a canon event scenario situation where like, yeah, maybe Hinata's alive right now, but they'll go and meet her and then she'll die because like, she's always fated to die.
Yeah.
And they'll have to try again. I don't know.
I forget which time travel story that is. And like I said, I'm sure there's actually more than one where it's like you try to change the future and it just doesn't change. Even if it changes in small ways, like the big moments still have to happen by some Akashic record or whatever.
Yeah, there's like the universe conspires to cause certain major events to occur. Yeah, that kind of
there's
thing.
There's also, this doesn't matter yet, but I think it might matter later, is we did learn a few, several episodes ago now that like Akun was the one who pushed Takemichi into like the subway to like start all this. And we think it's that other Tokyo Manji present day leader that we've mentioned a few times who like, we're assuming that it was him that kind of called the shots. So like,
yeah,
what's his big plan and how does that factor in? Cause we know we have to return to that somehow.
Like, right.
That guy has not been dealt with.
No, but like, I think that will happen, but I think from the current perspective, that's not even a thing anymore. Like end up being important, but like the fact that Akun pushed him isn't even a thing now. You know what I mean? Like that never technically occurred.
But the underlying motive of why he was told to do that, to even kick off this whole time travel thing, like that's still a little bit confusing to me. Like
I will
in that, how does that come about even though we're now in a new timeline?
Okay. So there's two things here. Here's how I see it. The one thing that isn't going to get explained anytime soon, I believe, is how did it start? Like, how did the time traveling start?
Yeah.
I don't think that's going to get explained anytime soon, if ever.
Sure.
But the other piece I feel confident about is that the fact that Akun was told to kill Mikey, or I keep calling him Mikey, the fact that Akun was told to kill Takemichi and push him under the train, I think that's moot now.
Okay.
I don't think that matters because that's not part of history anymore.
I was more getting at like the motive behind whatever this other character wants. Like he wants Takemichi dead.
I see what you mean. So that'll come. Yes. That'll manifest in another way. Yes,
because that character is still around and they haven't really dealt with him.
Yes.
So like he could do other things.
Yeah. The problem is that this show, I'm not really going to complain too much about the time travel here, but I just want to point out that, I'm sorry, it's ambiguous about how it treats the multiple timelines insofar because Takemichi and Naoto can perceive the changes.
As far as we know, no one else can.
Nobody else can. That makes sense, I guess. And a lot of time travel stories have situations and paradoxes where something can happen that can kick off the dominoes falling, and then that event can be undone, but then it doesn't change the fact that the dominoes fell. And yeah. I feel like that's what we're seeing here. Like,
sure,
Akun pushing him technically never happened, but it doesn't change the fact that we've been watching time travel occur. So
yeah.
But the question I have that I don't think is going to get explained because this show apparently is super long is why is there time travel?
Right. Yeah. Probably not worth thinking about it too much, but there's definitely going to be some big problem that arises in the next episode or maybe the episode after that. Like there has to be, obviously. So we'll see what it is.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I would say that I am generally really interested to see what happens in the next episode. Because I mean, I guess you're right. Like, would episode 12 be like the end of the first core of this season, I guess?
Yeah. So there's probably going to be some big stinger at the end.
Big twist. Yeah. So I am interested to see that. I'm a little, my only big letdown is just Takemichi just being goofy and I don't like him. Yeah. He's kind of the weak point of this show, but I like Mikey. I like Draken. I like the concept of the show. It's grown on me more than I thought it would. Just Takemichi being a goofball and the bad comedy and like his like just like I don't know ineptitude just kind of frustrates me sometimes.
It's one of my favorite words, ineptitude.
All right, well, let's finish out the episode with the latest episode of One Piece. One Piece episode 773, The Nightmare Returns, The Invincible Jack's Fierce Attack.
That's actually a title that, yeah, checks out.
Yeah, kind of happens in the second half of the episode, but it's there. Anyway, the episode starts and they're explaining that they, you know, they're reiterating about the fact that they want to meet with Marco and Luffy can't remember who Marco is. And then that's when Robin says, he looks like a pineapple.
And Luffy's like, oh, that guy. Why didn't you say that to the start? Why didn't you say that to begin with?
He does look like a pineapple. And then we learn about something that happened off screen, which was the battle between the Whitebeard Pirates and the Blackbeard Pirates.
Which is, I guess, so this is one of those terms I've heard, and I don't know if it's one of those things I just heard through osmosis or whatever. They called this the Grudge War.
Yeah.
Which took place 1 year after Marineford. So like during the time skip when everyone was off doing their training or whatever. So yeah, we kind of get this explicit explanation of this battle between like what remained of the Whitebeard Pirates and the Blackbeard Pirates, and the Whitebeard Pirates lost. That's how basically Blackbeard more or less, you know, solidified his position as an emperor. And Luffy hears this and he's like, I hate that guy.
Yeah.
So
yeah, and that's kind of like the last that they had heard from Marco.
Now we're not exactly sure. There's some chatter in this part where they mention like, yeah, Marco's super strong or whatever, and like he would be a great, really good asset. And it makes sense that Cat Viper and Dogstorm would know him, but is there like any other reason why they're needing to seek him out, or is it just for his like ability?
You know, I don't remember.
Like, I don't know if it's just as simple as we should seek him out because he's strong and he could help us, or if there's like something that he can do or he knows that no one else would be able to provide.
Right.
I don't know. So
yeah, I'm wondering the same thing. And even though I think the details of that have been lost to me, again, I don't have a lot of memory of Wano, so I don't remember what the deal is there.
It's probably interesting for you to rewatch this to kind of, you know.
Oh yeah, I mean, all this stuff that they're talking about now, which I kind of forgot about. I'm just like, oh yeah. But I actually don't even know. I don't know. I mean, only thing I know about Marco is that he has the Phoenix fruit, and that makes him very strong. And he was the one who saved Luffy at Marineford. That's all I know.
Yeah. And this is one of those context things that like makes sense when you think about it. But I had forgotten it specifically. Like, he was an ally and like a shipmate with Ace, who was also part of the Whitebeard Pirates. So like.
Yeah,
it makes sense that at that moment he'd be like, you know, in this big conflict at Marineford, like, okay, Ace is dead, but we have to protect his brother at all costs. Like, even though he didn't know Luffy, he knew Ace very well. So makes sense to me.
Yeah. You know, they're talking about, well, we're going to have to get back into Wano, but, you know, we're wanted men. How are we going to get in? And then Law just kind of offers up. He's like, well, you know, if I carry you on my submarine, you could get in there pretty easily. I'm willing to take you.
This is actually one of those things I should have written down, but I didn't. Luffy kind of creates his squad to go to get Sanji.
Correct.
And it's him, it's Nami, I think Brook. And is that it? Am I forgetting someone?
I think that's it. I think that's it, yes. I don't remember it. Exactly, but I think you're right. Yes, because it's not Frankie, it's not Robin, it's not Sanji. Or I mean, I'm not Sanji. Of course, not Sanji. Not Zoro. Yeah, that's it.
So I'm wondering, like, is this whole Whole Cake, you know, arc going to be, you know, focusing mostly in on the sort of like subset of the Straw Hats, which, you know, we've sort of seen that before. Like,
yeah, yeah. They definitely are splitting up here. That's what they're saying here. Mm-hmm. Also, right before the commercial break, Rizzo, all the Minks show up and they're all like, "We're so glad you're safe, Rizzo."
Yeah, and let's have a feast. And then, yeah, Rizzo does some ninja stuff that they're very happy about.
Yeah, he does the I love you technique, which is not a technique. It's a goofy thing that they do. Anyway, as they're kind of having the feast, that's when they decide, you know, they're talking about, okay, we're going to split up again. But then the ground starts shaking. Zunisha starts crying out. And we learn that Jack has started his attack and he is just shooting cannonballs at Zunisha's leg. And even though I wouldn't think it would do anything, I guess he says something like, oh, it's old. So it's like skin is thin. And so it's harming him.
Yeah. It's one of those things where it's just like, you don't think that shooting cannonballs at this gigantic elephant leg would, you know, be effective, but it is.
It would be like, it'd be like an ant landing on your leg. It's smaller than that, actually. So I'm just kind of surprised, but whatever. And,
By the way, I was looking it up. I think Chopper goes with Luffy also.
Oh, yes, yes. Chopper is another one that goes. You're right.
Yeah. I was clicking through the episode real quick. And yeah, it's Luffy, Nami, Brook, and Chopper. Seems like.
Okay. I forgot about Chopper. It saves
Sanji. Yeah.
Okay. Yes. And of course, they're going to take the mink guy, the lion guy. Yeah.
Well, I think now that I think about it, I think Chopper even mentions that, like, you know, Peckham's is injured. I have to make sure he's okay.
Right. Well, as the ground is shaking and everybody's getting tossed around, Luffy starts covering his ears and he's like, "What is this loud voice? I can't stop it." And Momo as well is like, it's like so loud and painful, this voice they're hearing. Nobody else can hear it.
And yeah, so we were teased on this a couple episodes ago when Momo heard the voice going up to Rizzo. He's like, anyone else hear that voice? It wasn't as loud then, and I don't think Luffy mentioned anything then, I don't think. But I think this is kind of the reprisal of that is, okay, there's this voice, it's really loud now, that seems to be the elephant. That Luffy can hear, Momo can hear. It's apparently like disorientingly loud, but no one else can hear it.
Right. And then the last thing we hear it say, we do hear it speak briefly, and then right before the to be continue, it says, "Give me an order," and that's the episode.
That's kind of an interesting, you know, conundrum, or, you know, like, okay, why can Momo and Luffy hear it, and no one else? Like, what's the connective? Like, what's the similarity between Momo and Luffy that would allow them to hear this voice, but no one else?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, like, you know, that seems like a mystery to me. Like, okay, so I'm thinking Momo is the son of, like, this shogun, this important Odin person. And it's just like Luffy is the son of Dragon. And I don't think he has any relationship to Momo, like, by blood or by power or by position. Like, I'm just trying to think, like, why can they hear it? And I'm sure this will be explained, hopefully. And, it, you know, there's got to be something that sets them apart. And that's kind of the, you know, the speculation is, I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. This is just another one of those kind of things that's cool about Zoe, where they're just, again, they're setting up big picture things. Right. And this is another one of those where it's like, what's going on here? This
and it's like, mystery. Is it a Willa D thing? Like, no, it's not, because Law would be able to hear it and he doesn't. So it's got to be something separate. That's a good point. Yeah. So.
Yeah, and that's the episode. We're really close to the end of the arc now. Let me double check here. I think we're like one or two episodes away from the filler. What did I say? 773?
That's the episode we just watched, yeah.
Yeah, so okay, there are three more episodes. There are three more episodes and then we get into the we're three more episodes and then we get into a little side thing that's canon, which is kind of cool actually. And there's like three episodes of that, and then we get the three episode filler, anime filler, and then we're done with Zoe. But in three episodes we will be leaving Zoe is what I'm getting at. So I'm kind of surprised. I mean, I don't, maybe I shouldn't be, but I'm just kind of like thinking back, like we're almost done with Zoe now, like on Toonami. I'm just like, wow, that's a lot. We've gone through a lot of episodes here. We went through all of Dressrosa.
Remember when One Piece left the block at like Thriller Bark-ish?
Yeah.
Somewhere on there. And then like we never saw Sabaody or Marineford. Can it came back and started at Fishman Island at the time skip, and we've seen everything since. So
I know that's great. We've seen everything post time skip. That's wild. Mm-hmm. Everything up till this point, I guess I should say.
Now there's no Naruto Shippuden to anchor the block, you know, for as long as Toonami lasts, like it's, you'd hope, like you might as well just keep One Piece chugging along in that slot.
Yeah. I'm really curious to see if we go into the next arc. I really do. I mean, I don't have any reason not to think it's going to happen, but if they do, it feels like a commitment, you know?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that's it for the rundown. Let's talk about flavor alerts.
Play flavor alert.
Potential award nominations.
I think we've even kind of like considered it before, but I think after this episode, I think we can just go ahead and say worst character. Do we have a worst? Yeah. Worst character, Takamichi. Like, he does bring the show down, I think.
I'm fine with that. Let's do it. All right. Worst character, Takamichi.
I like how, I don't like, but it's, Draken and Mikey are very consistent at always calling him Takamichi. Like, I guess that's just how it is.
Yeah.
And we already have Mikey and Draken as best character male, which I think after this episode is even stronger. Like, both those characters. They kind of make up for Takamichi.
Agreed. I think Crocodile says he wants to nominate the Evil Eye versus Team Momo.
Yeah, we already nominated Okarun versus the Evil Eye, but I think we basically had two good battles back to back, so that's fair. I think we can nominate two fights back to back.
Yeah. All right, so we find that. Yeah, that was an epic stuff. He also suggested Momo's hug being a best moment. I don't know. What do you think?
Sure.
I don't feel strongly about it, but I don't have a reason not to.
Yeah, we can not. I think just sure. Why not?
Okay.
It was a nice moment, but.
Yeah.
I'm looking at voice performances. I think even after this episode, like we nominated Abby Trott for Momo last week. And I think even after this episode, it's like, yeah, that was a good nomination.
Yes,
if we didn't nominate her last week, we would have nominated her this week. And we have, I think Isagi in Blue Lock, I think does a pretty good job, even though it's kind of silly with his like internal like monologues and getting tense and angry. You know, I think so. We already nominated that. I don't think like I'm thinking like, are any of the voice acting in like Tokyo Revengers like exceptional? And like, no, not really. Mm-hmm. Like I think like Draken and Mikey are suitable, but I don't know.
I'm not a very good judge of that stuff. I'll be honest with you.
Okay.
I don't know. I think it's good. I don't know if it's like amazing.
Right. That's kind of where I'm at.
Yeah. I'm thinking. We haven't done this before. I mean, this might be a good opportunity. I was thinking of nominating this Don to Don episode as a best episode of the year.
Oh, did we have that episode? We have that. Oh yeah, we do have a best episode category now. Let's write it down before we forget.
Okay.
On a Don episode 4.
Episode 11 or
episode 4, right?
4. It's episode 4. Or maybe I'll put the title.
Well, yeah.
Just so we know what we're talking about.
I'd say put the title and the episode like
okay.
S2E4 title.
Oh, good idea. Okay, yeah. Yeah, that was an amazing episode.
Best fight. KG versus Flooding Water. I don't think there's anything from Rooster Fighter that.
No, it's just the thing. I really want. I feel like I want to nominate them for Rooster Fighter, but then I'm never compelled to.
Yeah.
I think the show. Here's the thing I was wanting to say. Toonami Originals, this one has been pretty strong.
Yeah, weirdly enough.
I mean, it's not like so amazing that I'm going out and telling people they need to check it out. But I think as far as Toonami Originals go, I feel like they're really, this one's landing pretty well. So maybe it's something to do with the fact that I just didn't know what to expect from this as well. It's like, it's way better than I could have imagined.
This is kind of a cheating pick, but I think we can already nominate best character female Momo again.
Oh yeah, I'm for that.
Like, I think
okay.
It was one of those things that we're just kind of like, we just started the season, but she's already been great. So
oh yeah. Yeah, she's this episode especially.
Yeah.
She's a fully realized character in one of the best female characters I've enjoyed watching.
She won last year. So like,
yeah,
you know, just continuing her hot streak, I guess.
She's on to me, some of the best female characters ever were in like Full Metal Alchemist Brotherhood.
Yeah.
And to me, like Momo's on that level where it's like, this is like mm-hmm. written well.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think Ego is a best villain?
Best villain because he doesn't explain his plan properly.
Exactly.
Best villain, the Blue Lock dub dialogue writers.
Yeah, confusing.
I don't know. I think it's good for now.
Okay, I'm fine with that. While we're thinking about it too, real quick, since I've added that best episode for this week, I kind of forgot that category was there for a little while. And have there been any episodes in this past month or two that you thought might have been nominatable that we kind of should have nominated? Yeah,
like retroactively making sure we didn't miss anything.
Yeah.
Nothing immediate. Like
okay.
Anything from Tokyo Avengers up to this point? No. Anything from Blue Lock up to this point?
No.
Probably the best Blue Lock episode was probably the one we just saw, despite the confusion. But was it excellent? No. It was good. It was like for a Blue Lock episode, it was good. Anything from Rooster Fighter? No. Anything from like the last couple of episodes of Blue Exorcist? No. I don't think so.
No.
I might have to revisit like what happened at the end of season 4 of Blue Exorcist.
Average. I mean, I think the story part that's going on right now is interesting, but it's also just One Piece, so.
And One Piece is so slow that usually the interesting stuff is stretched out over multiple episodes. So it's hard to pick one that would be like this one.
Right. I think that if we ever get to Wano, there are definitely episodes in Wano that are going to be like incredible.
I know that people say that like episode number 1000, which I think is the one where he beats Kaido, I think, is like they went all out for the 1000th episode of One Piece. But we are like 3 years away from that or whatever, or maybe more, 4 years. So it'll be a while.
I remember the one I remember always being was like, there's episode 1013, which has this incredible sequence in it. That's just kind of like, I remember like a couple of years ago when we were talking about that in the Reset Era thread about it.
Right.
That being like, it's just like, it's taken the show to another level. Anyway.
But yeah, I can't think of any immediately like we need to nominate this episode. I think this Dun to Dun episode is probably the best one we've seen out of any show so far this year.
Agreed. Okay, well we'll leave it there then. Okay, and that will do it for episode 471 of the Toonami Escape podcast. I want to thank Crocodile for being here earlier, and I want to thank you for being here as well, Seda.
Yep, no problem.
We will be back next week for the same rundown. Really curious to see what happens to Tokyo Revengers. We'll see what happens with Dun to Dun as well. So until then, later.